Pseudopod, episode 365. Wow, we could repeat all of these and do one a day for a year. That's awesome! December 20th, 2013. This week's story, Whispers in the Dark by Andrew Marinus. Hello, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. With less than a week to go until Christmas, what better time to give you the gift of a brand new way to end the world? Whispers in the Dark has never been published before, and it's brought to us by Andrew Marinus. Andrew is a freelance contributor to Cracked.com, has been published in Black Petals in an anthology put out by The Horrorzine, and has a view of the end very close to my heart. So get comfy. But don't get too near the Christmas tree. Don't look at the Christmas tree. Do not acknowledge the Christmas tree, because Andrew has a story for you. A true one, and as long as you close your eyes, you may live to hear it.
Whispers in the Dark by Andrew Marinus. So the guy we found under the stairs starts screaming, and when Roger shakes him it doesn't help, and when Roger slaps him it doesn't help, and when Roger beats the shit out of him he still doesn't quiet down, so we leave him there on the floor. Maybe he's seen, maybe he hasn't. It comes down to the same. Don't want to be trucking with someone who can't keep their mind from spilling out of their mouth. It's getting to be around 3:30, near enough to twilight that this will be our last street cross for the night. It's been an unproductive 5 hours. The part of the city we're in's got mostly just office buildings and parking garages, not much food to be found. Still, Alan found a few bags of chips left behind by a raided vending machine, so that's something. As we get ready to head outside, we split up the chips equally between us, so that if only one of us makes it, their fair share will be with them and not with a gibbering lunatic or a fleshless corpse. Just before Roger opens the door, Alan puts on his face mask. I leave my eyes uncovered, figuring the darkness will be enough. Maybe this makes me less crazy than him. Maybe. The blackness outside is mercifully total. Clouds smothered whatever light the moon might be able to provide. We head out, turn east, and get into formation. Me on the left, Alan on the right, Roger in the middle, about a meter between each of us. We start walking. Between each step we freeze for about 5 seconds, listening. It rarely helps, listening, but each of us can remember at least one time when it saved someone, so we keep doing it. Mostly what we hear is the low night breeze, and every few minutes or so, screams or laughter off in the distance. When it's laughter, it goes on for quite a while before stopping. When it screams, it cuts off pretty quick. It's been less than a month since, leave it at that, and I've already started to forget what it looked like outside during the day. Right now, the three of us are walking across a four-lane street between two office buildings, I guess, but it's hard to imagine the open streets and the 20-story towers like you used to be able to see them. Nowadays, the streets are just the blackness around you, the clapping of your shoes on the road, and the smell of cold pavement. 20 steps across the void between buildings, I actually hear something, a kind of low rasp, like a dying asthmatic, and I whisper, "Stop." Alan and Roger freeze. Technically speaking, we never have to whisper. They don't seem to be able to hear, otherwise they'd get us just by the sound of our footsteps and the laughter of the insane. But we always do, so the conversation that follows is hushed, hurried. I tell them what I heard, that I think it came from directly in front of us. Roger asks if I'm sure, yes. Then if Alan heard anything, no. And then, after a long pause, asks us if we want to change direction. I understand the math. Going forwards means the shortest, most direct route from where we are to where we're going. If we redirect left or right before continuing, that means more space we have to pass through that could be occupied. If I didn't actually hear anything, that means we're risking ourselves for nothing. But I did hear something, I'm sure of it. So I do what needs to be done and lead us as we redirect left. So if my redirect runs us into something, it'll be me that runs into it. After 10 steps, I figure we've gone far enough wide of the noise and we turn back in our original direction. 5 steps later, from my far right, there's a sound like a hand sliding through gelatin, and then Alan starts screaming. Then there's the sound, which can only be compared to suction. Nobody I've met has known what causes it exactly, but on the rare occasion that a body's been recovered after the fact, it's just wet bones and tendons. What I think is that they suck the skin and organs right off of you, that what you hear is the person's soft bits getting liquefied and hoovered up. At any rate, Alan's screams cut off after a few seconds, and the sound cuts off maybe a minute after that. And then Roger and I start moving forwards again, calmly, not saying a word. There's nothing to say. It's pretty simple, really. Those who see start laughing. Those who get caught start screaming. There was this university professor I was with for a week or so near the beginning of things who had a lot to say about them. His method of coping, I guess, trying to figure them out using all his learned skills of biology. He thought that since they were, as far as we knew, pretty much motionless and were always located outside, they were probably some offshoot of the Plantae kingdom. Maybe they even derived energy from the sun. He never seemed interested in talking about what kind of plant would be able to instantly drive a person insane. He was pretty sure that they could see and move around at least a little, if need be. By then, people had tried walking in the day with their eyes covered, and all of them had started screaming pretty quickly. So in the day, even if you can make sure you can't see them, they can see you. At night, all are equally blind, and we even have a bit of a lead in that we can hear, and they apparently can't. That bit always confused the professor. As night hunting goes, deafness is a pretty big weakness to have. Regarding their appearance, the professor was, naturally, unsure. The fact that all it took was one touch for them to get you seemed to indicate that they either had adhesive skin or else some kind of impossibly fast prehensile limbs. Otherwise, at least some people would be able to get away after making contact. He was pretty sure they were firmly attached to the ground, which in a lot of cases meant solid pavement, and that some extension of them had a subterranean role. A lot of people had tried to use the sewers as a safe way of getting around, and none had ever come back up. He said he'd heard about someone trying to set them on fire with predictably disastrous results. Fire meant light, which meant vision, which gave them a distinct advantage over the person setting the fire. More than anything else, he lamented over how he wished he could have a sample of whatever substance they were made of. So far as I know, that's what ended up killing him one night. He went out alone, carrying a pretty long knife. I never heard from him again. Personally, I don't really care about much of all that. It doesn't help you survive. For that, you just got to know the rules. Only go out when it's too dark to see. If you hear something, keep away from it. The shortest route between two points is the route least likely to be occupied. But I got to admit, I wonder what they look like. I've seen so many people get sloppy, look out a window during the day, or take a picture around a corner and look at it, and then just lose it. Their eyes hollow out, darken, and then the laughter starts. Usually, anyways. Some just going off themselves, out a window or with a gun, if they have one. Or they just go strutting out into the dark, laughing or singing, eventually going quiet. No screams for them. I wonder what they could see that would do that to them. Is it something so alien that their brain just can't process it? Or is it something too familiar? A shape, a face maybe, that echoes through them, shattering important things deep inside. I don't know. And I don't know if maybe I want to see that face, to get one last laugh on my way out. It seems like the insane are the only happy ones around these days. The building Roger and I set up in for the day turns out to already have a tenant. One guy, twitchy, but still cruising on the proper ratio of terminal fear and unshakable calm. Name's Aaron. He shows us around the place, admitting that there isn't much in the way of food left. He's been holed up there for a few days, working through the remains of the building's vending machines. Still, there's bottled water and some beef jerky left, enough for all of us, and we're grateful. We find rooms as far inside, away from daylight, as possible. We sleep. When we wake up, it's only 6:30, so we spend the evening looking around for pictures or maps of the area outside the building. I shouldn't have to explain why we can't just look out the window, or why we walk with our eyes looking straight down at our feet, just in case. We find some evacuation maps that show us which direction the closest building's in. Unfortunately, it doesn't say whether the building in question's an office stack, a parking garage, or joy of possible joys, a supermarket. Aaron doesn't know. He came here from the same direction we did. Around 9, as we're preparing to head out, it starts raining. Technically speaking, this is bad news. Can't hear shit in the rain. But we're fine with it. Walking through anything is better than walking through dead black silence. We split up our supplies between us. We walk out the door. The rain's coming down pretty heavy, which makes it the closest thing to a shower I've had in going on a week. The road we have to cross is 6 lanes, according to the evacuation map, with an abundance of sidewalk on each side. We walk in the standard formation, me in the middle, Roger on the left, Aaron on the right. Nobody ever wants to take the lead. About a third of the way across the road, we hear it and freeze. Thunder. Thunder means lightning. I shut my eyes on instinct. We whisper to each other over the rain. Should we go on? Go back? I'm pretty sure that we're about to do the latter when the blackness on the other side of my closed eyelids flashes orange. White light is seen through the membrane of blood. From my right, there is laughter. From my left, screams. Soon enough, both fall silent and I'm alone. Well, not really. Somehow they didn't see me, or they couldn't reach me. In any case, I'm outside, and at any moment more lightning could spotlight me for them, so I start walking again. Not the measured, calculated steps I'm used to, though. Full steps at a brisk pace. What's there to stop and listen for, anyways? I imagine how it all must look, lit by the lightning, the rain blasting down on me, and the street, and all these things that must be around me now. The professor compared them to trees, standing in wait for someone to wander by out of nowhere. I remember an old book from way back, The Giving Tree, and I start to laugh. It feels good. I'm probably the only person in the world who's laughing and not insane. I'm walking and roaring as I picture the street around me filled with goddamn trees of all things. Trees surrounded by corpses. Trees that break minds and render flesh to liquid. My laughter's winding down. I have to desperately claw just to keep a grip on the humour while I run from the truth. What's around me now aren't trees, aren't plants, aren't anything that I can understand. They're evidence that our senses and minds have been locked away in a basement room, neglected, left to see only cobwebs and shadows. They're from outside. They're other. They're else. And I damn well want to see what the face of an outsider looks like. The worst part is I can't even stop walking. My legs refuse to obey the desire to stand in this street until the sun rises and see all that the light can reveal. The funny side of things. The joke that seems to be catching these days. No, my legs keep propelling me forwards through this blackness, driven by survival, uninterested in whatever laughter and insanity have to offer. It's almost as if...
The removal of a sense is a peculiar kind of horror all by itself. I've talked about it before, how there's always an instinct to jump, to push, to unfetter yourself from rationality and do the thing the back of your brain is screaming at. The healthy version of that instinct leads to adrenaline sports. The unhealthy side leads to everything from bar fights to addiction and death. We do anything, anything at all, to fill that gap, whatever it is. What Andrew does here, that I think is especially clever, is combine that instinct with a beautiful workaround for the traditional horror monster problem. Because horror monsters are always a problem. You see, monster writers have to constantly walk a fine line between showing you too much and showing you enough to know how much trouble the characters are in. It's a very difficult line to walk, especially as there's often an extremely large, very angry thing on one side of it. But Andrew does two things here that sidestep every problem. The first is that this apocalypse has already happened, and, in fact, has been happening for a while. It's a smart move, allowing him to give the story real immediacy. That's backed up by the way we never see the plants. We just see and hear the effect of them. Perhaps, in this case, true horror isn't seeing something approach. Perhaps true horror is knowing it's standing just outside arm's reach, patiently waiting for the moment you can't take it anymore. And you open your eyes. That image of the patient, whip-smart hunters would be terrifying enough on its own, but the cherry on the Sunday of Doom here is the way in which every possibility has always been run through. You can't tunnel under them, you can't look at them, you can't go near them, because they'll find you and do something impossibly horrific to you as you die quickly. There is no square-jawed hero. There is no last-minute two-fisted scientific one-shot in a million. There is just the end. And whether you wait for it to come to you, or you run at it eyes wide, your personality falling away like the wings of Icarus as you die. No bravery, no sacrifice, no future. Just them. Waiting. Hungry. Patient. Forever. Happy Christmas! Seriously, actually, happy Christmas. I'll talk more about the year next week, but for now, I want to thank some people for the role they've played in our year. From the very top. Paul and Allison, our publisher, accountant, and web guru. Scarlett, the legal genius. Our editors, the magnificent Norm Sherman at Escape Pod, the Captain Picard to my Riker. Sean Garrett at Pseudopod, the horror Captain Picard to my Riker. Dave Thompson and Anna Schwind at Podcastle. Maybe Data and Counselor Troy. Maybe Tasha Yar. I don't know. The next gen metaphors kind of got away from me, but they're all awesome people. Our audio engineers, Matt Weller, Graham Dunlop, Peter Wood, without whom those shows literally would not exist. And our slush wranglers, Nathan Lee, Talia, Itansvig, Oxycat, Angela Lee, Rachel Jones, John Stimson, Bedoomed, all of them. Fantastic, endlessly hard-working volunteers. This is a volunteer army, never forget that. And I can honestly say I've never worked with a group of people more motivated. Thank you all. And thank you all for not only listening, but giving us feedback and helping out when we needed it. Because we did. And because, believe me, you did. Without you, next week would be a very different outro. And it means the world that you showed up and continue to show up to help. The things we have planned for 2014, you will not believe. And trust me, you're a vital part of them all. Especially you. Yeah, you. You're driving the helicopter. So for now, with 4 days till Christmas, I leave you with this. Have a fantastic time. Whatever you choose to do, however you choose to celebrate, family, friends, by yourself, it doesn't matter. You're amazing people, each and every one of you. Go have a cookie. Seriously, I am. Pseudopod relies on you to pay our authors and cover our server costs, so if you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. That'll give you two options, subscribe or donate. Donations, we love them, but they're short term. What's better for us, and what only puts you a little bit out of pocket, are subscriptions. Starting at $2 a month, subscribers get all the promo content we have planned, and we have a lot on deck for next year. I out the price of a couple of candy bars a month and ensure we always have $2 less to find. So please, if you can, and we will understand if you can't, believe me, go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. Pseudopod will return for our epic final story of the year from hot up-and-comer action writer Jack London next week. It's a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Remember, Pseudopod will return next week, but first of all, remember this. Keep him out of the light. He hates bright light, especially sunlight. It'll kill him. Secondly, don't give him any water, not even to drink. But the most important rule, the rule you can never forget, no matter how much he cries, no matter how much he begs, never feed him after midnight.